hearts ashamed. Too many of us are going insane.
Vancouver's downtown east side is one of Canada's most impoverished and destitute urban neighborhoods, often marked as the poorest postal code in Canada. Home to an estimated 5,000 injection drug users, the downtown east side suffers from one of the worst urban epidemics of HIV/AIDS in the world. I had the opportunity to interview and speak with residents and community organizers of Vancouver's downtown east side in February 2004 for CKUT Radio in Montreal. The on-the-street discussions and interviews touched on a variety of important issues directly relating to those struggling to survive in Vancouver's downtown east side, such as police brutality, homelessness, Indigenous self-determination, poverty, safe injection sites for drug users, the rights of sex workers, and many other issues directly relating to life and death in Vancouver's downtown east side. We will begin this program with an interview recorded on East Hastings with a Native activist who spoke about the realities of homelessness, poverty, and the need for social housing.
People make it to be a complex problem, but really it isn't. It's people needing to dig into their pockets and digging into their hearts and saying, yeah, we could do something for these people, rather than trying to make a buck off of it. You know, I find so many Indigenous people coming here in hopes of finding work because, you know, fishing is almost gone now. There's no fish out there anymore. And the trees, they're all gone, so, you know, people come here in hopes of finding work and finding nothing. The way this welfare has been set up and playing games with everyone, you know, and it's really difficult for a lot of people. I mean,
can you talk about how the changes which the Liberal government has pushed forward have affected people directly in this neighborhood, the welfare cuts and so on?
It's appalling. It's just terrible. I mean, I've lived in Vancouver 13 years now, and I've never seen it so devastating, and I can't see how anybody could just ignore the fact that people are sleeping outside. I watch the news and I see people taking more consideration for a cat and dog than a fellow human being.
A lot of people from the neighborhood have said that the rest of Vancouver and also the rest of Canada consistently attempts to close their eyes and block out the reality, which is the downtown east side, the reality of police brutality, the reality of homelessness.
Yeah.
So can you maybe speak about the responsibility that you feel people in Greater Vancouver and also throughout Canada have to assisting the struggle of people for a better life here in this neighborhood?
I'd like to see more social housing happening. I'd like to see treatment on demand. I don't quite understand the gist of this insight. I mean, the cost of having that run is astronomical, and that kind of money can really actually help people in turn of, you know, getting out of their addiction if they wish. I mean, people have looked after each other long before that insight had opened, right? And I think it's just a huge waste of money. There should be more safe houses for women. I've talked to people when I was working with Insight for a month, the short month I was there, and the women, they always said there needs to be more treatment centers for women, more safe houses, and here they are spending all this money for people to go shoot up.
Can you maybe speak about the relationship between residents of this neighborhood, homeless people and non-homeless people, and the Vancouver police? You know, can you speak about maybe instances of police brutality that you have seen?
I was part of Wood Squat, and
can you explain what Woodward Squat is and what it was about?
That was about social housing, and then in turn, homeless people showed up, and then brought to light just the real problem around homelessness. And since then, I've gotten involved in trying to help those who live outside. And there's just not enough emergency shelters. I see people sleeping on the streets, you know, in front of stores, back alleys, under bridges, viaducts, and it's just appalling.
the conduct of the police in the neighborhood?
They raided us twice at the Wood Squat, and it was terrible. I mean, people are homeless, and then to take everything they own, you know, what little they have, and then throw it into garbage truck, shame, you know. And then just a while back, say this past summer, I saw a couple of police on foot patrol going by the St. James Church and going up to the stairs and starting to harass people that were sleeping there, you know, kicking them and telling them to get up and get out. I got up there and I said, shame, picking on homeless, shame. And they told me to keep moving on, so I just circled around and kept bugging them, right?
That's the reality of police conduct in a lot of ways in this neighborhood.
Yeah, and that's no solution. Yeah, I mean, anyone with some common sense realize, you know, where do they go, right? I mean, it's just not right that people get pushed around.
A lot of residents of this neighborhood are indigenous people. Maybe could you talk about the realities of this neighborhood in terms of homelessness, poverty, police brutality, in terms of the indigenous reality of things?
I've heard so many people speak about it. There's so many organizations out there, and they're not Native run, but they say they have a concern for Natives. And yet I don't see it, because far too many Native people are suffering in poverty, right? And it's a very difficult situation to get out of when you don't have a fixed address. You don't have, you know, the proper attire to find a job. You don't have the communication, don't have a phone, right? Probably not even the education or the skills that would take to get a proper job.
How do you feel about the importance of grassroots organizing in the community, you know, organizing on the streets, organizing with those directly affected, homeless people, drug users? What importance do you feel that voice has in terms of changing this situation?
I start to see it more and more. More and more people are starting to get organized and start to group together. And I think the more we do that, we'll start to see some accomplishments here, right?
You are listening to a radio documentary compiling interviews and on-the-street conversations recorded in Vancouver's downtown east side for CKUT Radio in Montreal. We will now hear an interview with David Cunningham, an organizer with the Anti-Poverty Committee and the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. The interview focuses on the history of homelessness and poverty in Vancouver's downtown east side and large amounts of grassroots community organizing which is currently taking place to fight poverty and homelessness.
My name's David Cunningham. I moved to Vancouver about 4 years ago, and I found myself on the streets of the downtown east side. And at the time, I was a drug user. And smoking crack cocaine, and I was immediately involved with the drug scene down here, being entrenched within it. Eventually, friends of mine took me up to the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users office, and there I met my brothers and sisters who were in the same situation, facing the same persecution that I was, and realized that only by banding together in such an organization could we defend each other's rights and advocate, you know, our demands that we felt were fit.
Can you explain that? Can you explain what the organization's about? You're banding together for what? And what are those demands you're talking about?
Sure. I think first you have to give a proper context to Vandu. It is in Canada's largest drug ghetto. And when we say drug ghetto, we don't just mean like an area of town that has a lot of drugs in it, but an institutionalized quarantine, where for many people that live on the streets and in the shelters of the downtown east side, we can't find any escape. One from the detoxes that our welfare workers force us to go into, and then we're released at the end of the month back on Main and Hastings, which is the nucleus of the drug ghetto, as well as a lot of us are red zoned from leaving the downtown east side. There's armies of security guards that pretty much flank all the neighborhoods around the downtown east side. So given that, there's a definite reflection of who lives in the downtown east side, the poorest drug ghetto or neighborhood, postal code, in Canada. So you don't have to strike two sticks together to spark, obviously, that most people down here are going to be Aboriginal women, Aboriginal children, and men. There's a history of what we call in Vancouver the Highway of Tears that leads from northern BC right into the downtown east side. This, unfortunately, is a road traveled by many women, many of our sisters that have disappeared through the sex trade work or through other atrocities in the downtown east side. So the majority of our organization are Aboriginal men and women. The last count that I heard, we have the second largest population of Aboriginal people in a political organization, the first being the First Nations, the second being the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. So with a membership of over 1,000, probably a few hundred active members, hundreds of our members over the years have passed on, or what we say have paid the ultimate price in the drug war, who have been killed by the system. So given the realities that we face in the organization, a lot of organizing is a struggle. You know, they call it struggle for a reason, more so when you're at ground zero of the atrocity caused by poverty. So we work around the isolations that are felt by drug users living in such horrendous poverty. We deal with that by giving them an organization, giving them a voice, a space for people to come together without the ridicule or humiliation that a lot of other services and church groups offer down here. So by that, it gives us the opportunity as well to pass on the message of harm reduction, and not just rhetorically or symbolically, but we have members of our organization walking through the back alleys of the downtown east side, exchanging needles for dirty rigs, giving out clean rigs, condoms, water. We have organizations that, sub-organizations of VANDU that deal specifically with our Aboriginal brothers and sisters and the issues facing them. We have subcommittee groups that deal with people with hepatitis C, people who are forced to take methadone, and an organization called the Housing Action Committee that deals with the living conditions and the overall persecution of individuals in the downtown east side.
You talked about people being boxed in, being isolated in the downtown east side. Can you maybe go into detail as to how you see this as being perpetuated, both economically and politically, by municipal business interests in the city of Vancouver and also by municipal politicians? I mean, earlier we were speaking and you said that the downtown east side is one of the largest money makers in Vancouver, or the largest money making neighborhood. So can you maybe expand on these things?
Sure. And again, I'm going to give a quick context, a historical context, to reference what is happening in the downtown east side and what I would argue has always been happening in the downtown east side. Since the beginning of the ghetto, it was manufactured to be a ghetto. And from what I understand, the term skid given to poor neighborhoods originated from Vancouver. I could be wrong, but that's why we call the skids down here. And this is from back in the 30s and 40s with the loggers who worked up in the mountains and logging and whatnot. When they get their breaks or a time off during the winter or whatever seasonal shifts that they had, they'd come down to the skids, like rolling the skids with like the logs down the water. So they come down to the skids, which is what we now call the downtown east side, where they would, there's tons of bars, there's tons of heroin, well, opium back then, lots of sex trade work, brothels, and whatnot. And the city turned, they'd like to say that they turned a blind eye to it. They knew it was happening, but they made sure that it happened only in this specific part of the city, and made sure that none of it were to leak out into the more respectable, quote unquote, neighborhoods that surrounded the skids. So over years of more and more people impoverished showing up in the downtown east side, and they'd show up here because it's the cheapest rooms that you could rent, SROs, single resident occupancies, and they go for $325, $350 now, the equivalent of your shelter portion in the welfare check. But when you take the size of the hotel room, it's the highest priced housing per square footage in Vancouver, and one of the highest in Canada. So people are paying more than anywhere else to live in a box in a shithole, and paying more than a rich yuppie in West Van and whatnot. So over the years of more people being forced economically to live into the downtown east side, hotels around it, real estate around it being shut down with the expo, we saw a huge influx of people moving more into the center of the downtown east side. More sex trade workers from reserves, and I don't mean that in a racist way, but really a lot of people are showing up from reserves and they couldn't live anywhere else in the city except for the downtown east side. And there's more and more people showing up, and more and more drugs showing up. We don't have time to get into the connections between poverty and drugs, but it's a reality that, you know, any of us that know anything understand. So you had heroin hitting the scene abruptly and hitting very hard. A lot of former longshoremen, a lot of people who've been working all their lives, who are no longer receiving any medical care, or their prescriptions ran out, found the next cheapest substitute, which is opium, right? It's what it's always been used for. So a lot of people got hooked on the heroin. A lot of people who had been tinkering with heroin moved into the downtown east side because it was available. Again, the police in the city were turning a blind eye. So this was happening for about a decade, then crack hit the scene. And that's when the downtown east side has taken on the characteristic that it's arguably taken on now, which is just, you know, an atrocity. People are dying on the street corners. People are dying on the streets.
You have direct contact with a lot of people living on the streets or involved heavily in the drug scene. You yourself having been a part of that at one time. When you talk to people, what is their vision for improving their situation and improving the livelihood of people in the neighborhood? You talked about people's movements, the growth of people's movements, people in the downtown east side having a very automatic inclination of understanding how to fight for their rights. You talked about that, but you know, maybe just tell a couple stories of you know, conversations you've had or, you know, dialogues you've had with people about their vision of how they're going to fight this system, which continues to perpetuate, you know, this ghetto.
I don't like to use the words thrown way too much at the downtown east side, which is, you know, a horrendous drug ghetto, but community. A sense of real community, not a community that's determined by its postal code, but by people coming together and engaging with one another, with respect and showing each other, you know what they expect from one another. You see that coming out of Vandu. Like, this is arguably like groups of the most alienated, fucked over, fucked up people in Canada, right? If not like the developed countries, if not in some cases, in a lot of cases, the world, I think. You know, we have a highest rate of Hep C in the world, the HIV, the AIDS down here are like amazing. Like, when we talk about life and death in the downtown east side, we mean it. Like, people are dying every day. At the end of every Vandu meeting, through the six different subgroups that come out of Vandu, at the end of every meeting, we have a moment of silence for our brothers and sisters that have paid the ultimate price. And every day, it's different names. Every day it's different names. And after a while, going to these meetings, you know, you're not just hearing the names anymore. You remember their faces. You talked to them the other day. They smiled at you after a demonstration. They came up and said, you know, how good they felt, you know, empowered. We're sitting around talking, having smokes and shit. Like, you kind of get choked up thinking about it, because it's like, these are people that you love and they're fucking dying, and you're saying, who's responsible for this, right? Like, you want to just throw a fucking brick or shoot a fucking cop or, you know, like extreme things. But you look, it's the system that's doing this. It's, you know, it's fire and safety, fucking people coming in, closing down people's rooms, mental health institutions. It's like all over the board. There's not one face or one politician or an acronym you can put on it. It's the state working together coherently and very efficiently in killing our brothers and sisters. So when you have us come together and, you know, even demonstrating on the street, which to the trained activist doesn't seem like that much, but that's a huge fucking step to march on off the sidewalk onto the streets and confront your enemy, confront your oppressor and say, you know, I'm not fucking scared. I don't care if you're going to find me in the back alley tonight shooting up and kick my ass, which happens all the time after demonstrations, but I'm with my brothers and sisters now. This is real fucking community, and we're going to do whatever we can to bring more people into this, to fight harder. And you see that, you see pockets, you know, I know there's a term like pockets of resistance, but there's pockets of community in the downtown east side, and those communities are the resistance. And those pockets can't be destroyed, because people believe in it so much. There's so much heart, there's so much strength and so much spirit in it, that the police, you know, they can beat us, they can put us in jail, they can shoot us, but they can never get rid of that sense of community so long as we're alive. And when one dies, we pick up their struggle. Like, we have a saying that it's kind of a takeoff on a saying that, you know, our enemies use, and that's the heart of the community. They call a certain institution in the downtown east side the heart of the community. And we say it's the struggle, our struggle, which is the heart of the community. And one of our brothers and sisters dies, that's a piece of our heart that falls off on the side, the heart of the community. But for every person that we bring back in, that we can take off the streets, that we can take out of the shelters, that we can bring into our pockets of community, then that adds on back to the heart. And with you know, the amount of Aboriginal people and people that have lived and died through some of the most horrendous stuff, to be exposed to this spirit, you know, it's the most empowering thing that can happen to you in your life, for sure. At one hand, it's the most horrendous, atrocious thing that you'll ever see, but on the other, it's the most beautiful and inspiring.
You have been listening to an interview with David Cunningham, a community organizer in Vancouver's downtown east side who works with the Anti-Poverty Committee and the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. We will now hear a short interview recorded in an alley of the downtown east side with an activist who works with the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, who spoke about the struggle against poverty from the perspective of a drug user on Vancouver's downtown east side.
And of course there are systemic problems with the drug use, the drug sales going on in this community, and the police and the city are trying to address it, but we can't keep saying not my backyard without some intervention like treatment options. And how we expect the dealers to leave, when you take out one dealer out of one part of the community, demand always says, oh, I'm going to supply. Let's say that guy's there now, he's the dealer. They take him away. There'll be five dealers wanting to replace him. They all want that spot because they know it's a good spot. Then the cops are wondering, why is this going on? Why is there more and more dealers showing up? Well, that's the reason why.
What are some of the biggest issues you're facing in this community right now today? In terms of poverty, in terms of police violence, what are some issues that come to mind that are most important to you as somebody from this community?
For housing. The low-income housing is okay, but there's no phone, there's no place to actually go use a washroom if you're not in a house. But the housing that is available is not very good, it's not the greatest. And trying to access yourself to a phone, so let's say a person does want to seek treatment or seek detox, the detox people need to call you. Need to be able to phone you. And that's not being available to the residents of here in the downtown east side very well. It is being addressed somewhat, but not completely, not comprehensively.
Maybe can you talk about the safe injection site that was set up by the government? How do you feel about it? What's its relationship to the community down here?
Well, the safe site was here to establish some sense of safety and decrease the seroconversion rate and the mortality rate of the people that use intravenous drug use. It's doing its best there. However, there's a lot of intravenous drug users that are red zone. That means that they're not allowed in the 100 block East Hastings. So where are they going to go? Where are they going to be able to safely fix? If they go fix in a hotel, they're probably going to not be with the world's greatest partner. Their partner just learned how to do drugs just anywhere. Well, we do have that option in the safe site for the ones that can use it. How to fix properly, how to do vein maintenance. Well, they can't do that if they're red zoned. It's the safe site's great, but we need more than one. We need them in a few areas of the downtown east side or throughout the community. Much like the city has done, they've allowed needle exchanges in every clinic in Vancouver. That's a good thing. That makes it so the downtown east side is not a honeypot for drug users.
You mentioned housing, but lack of housing in the neighborhood, homelessness.
It's a number of issues that come up regarding that is how do we provide low-income housing or just ordinary housing for people that, you know, have a difficult time understanding the language that's now existing throughout the social services network. They make it really complicated to be able to jump through these hoops, more and more complex. Just really downplays the idea of, oh, I guess I can't get a house. I keep coming across these roadblocks and these hoops. Oh, well, so what? I guess I'll have to go do something else other than try to find housing here. But it's like that in every neighborhood. They just don't want people that are marginalized or look marginalized or stigmatized. And there's a lot of stigmatism that goes with poverty. To me, it's a bit of responsibility for the people that that don't have housing, that they ought to be able to access housing better. It's a meeting halfway, and it's difficult when the services that are provided aren't sensitive to the needs of the people that are actually poor and probably less educated than they have been 5-10 years ago. They're not sensitive to the needs of the community.
You've been listening to an interview with the community organizer who works with the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, who spoke about the struggle against poverty from the perspective of a drug user in the downtown East Side. We will now hear an interview with Jill Chatia, an organizer with the Anti-Poverty Committee, who speaks about community organizing against poverty in the downtown East Side, specifically focusing on the current Liberal government of British Columbia.
Some of the most important alliances that we've built over the past year, 2 years, have been sort of based on that line of thinking, right? So, for example, the history that APC has of working with VANDU, the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, and within VANDU, more specifically, the Housing Action Committee, has been really important and instrumental in terms of making sure that we are responding politically to like the needs of people who are living and dying in this ghetto, right, of the downtown East Side, and addressing also and making sure that the issues that sometimes folks have around things like demos are always at the forefront of our mind, right? Like, so you don't build a, you understand, I think, or you need to understand at some point that when you're building a direct action or any kind of action campaign around an issue that affects poor people, understand that there are concerns and issues that are affecting people that will compromise maybe how or what kind of direct action they can partake in. It might be warrants outstanding. It might be the Ministry of Children and Families is watching them very closely. It could be, the whole scene on the street here might be something that's a compromising factor for people. And just being poor and being on welfare, going into your welfare office and like occupying it, for example, is maybe not the greatest idea for people. It might get them like, they could end up being persecuted on their sort of day-to-day survival vis-a-vis like their file with welfare because of what they've done politically. So that's something that always has to be at the forefront of people's minds when organizing from a position of sort of relative privilege with a group that doesn't have necessarily all the privilege that a lot of organizers come to the table with, right? And it's beyond just the population of the downtown East Side, for example. If you're organizing in a refugee or people without status, like those kinds of communities, there's similar concerns. So it's that same kind, I think, of ethic that you take leadership on the kind of actions that you take from the people who are going to be the most directly affected by what you're protesting against and by the kinds of the steps that you're taking. Mm-hmm. You don't want to fuck people over even further by the line of action that you're taking, because that would just be beyond the beyonds, or it would just, you know, well, why are you doing what you're doing, right? Like, whose interests are you serving at that point? And what kind of movement are you building if in the meantime you're compromising people, right? It's like, when it comes down to it, it's like, I think organizers within APC, we all have that or recognize that while we fight to with sort of what seem like, or definitely are, these reformist demands, right? Of like, and the 2-year time limit and the 3-week wait, all these things sort of answering directly to the policies that are set up by repressive settler state governments, right? Like, we recognize that those are imperialist governments that are squatting indigenous land, and squatting is the wrong word to use, but that are occupying indigenous land, and that, you know, and for a lot of us in our personal long-term visions politically, we don't see recognizing those governments' authority as being necessarily important. But when it comes to like fighting for points of day-to-day survival for people, it is important. Those things help people get by, and they're incredibly important. And victories in that realm are, they're sort of what keep people going, right?
You've been listening to an interview with Jill Chatiar, a community organizer in the downtown East Side with the Anti-Poverty Committee. We will now hear an interview with Anton Pilipa, an organizer with the Anti-Poverty Committee. I spoke with Anton about the establishment of growingly powerful movements of homeless and poor people in the downtown East Side.
Hello, my name is Anton Pilipa, and I am a member of the Anti-Poverty Committee since its inception about 2 years ago. the basic driving ideas of the Anti-Poverty Committee. One would be definitely that when you look at the politics of Vancouver, the politics of British Columbia, there is an obvious lack of voice, lack of power for vast majority of people who are working people, who are low income, poor, living in ghettos and low income neighborhoods, run down slums of Vancouver. These people work a lot, these people have to hustle a lot, and they don't have a lot of say in what's going on, and they're getting screwed on a continuing basis.
How are you organizing in the downtown east side, and how exactly do you see this neighborhood, the downtown east side, as a ghetto?
It has been the main ghetto of Vancouver for well over 50 years. The city and the province have long pursued a policy of concentrating social housing, government services, etc. in this area. It's traditionally been an area where people move to if they're recent migrants to Canada, recent migrants to Vancouver. Low-income people are concentrated here in social housing. Government services, such as they exist, have been concentrated here. Deinstitutionalized mental patients have been for the most part, this is where they find themselves. A lot of the active street-level drug trade exists in the downtown east side. Obviously, also, there's important links between that and the active street-level survival prostitution trade. So, in many cases, this downtown east side is like a world historic ghetto. It's got a large concentration of substandard housing, large concentration of people who live far below the poverty line, a large concentration of Native people, and off-reserve Natives, and we find ourselves here for a large part just because a big chunk of the issues around Vancouver and around poverty are concentrated in the downtown east side. Vancouver has this sort of navel-gazing relationship with the downtown east side. People voyeuristically get off on looking at the misery that exists in Vancouver. The fact that the city concentrates it here is not just useful for keeping property values high in Shaughnessy and South Vancouver and Killarney, etc. Not only does it have serve certain economic purposes, it also serves very important political ones. Because issues coming out of this population of desperate people can often be minimized as, number one, coming out of a geographic area that's historically troubled, almost like somebody magically dropped a bomb there or something, and everybody's just suffering some sort of radiation poisoning. It also marginalized people in that it's sort of that the horrors are so concentrated, people kind of look at gas and go, oh, well, it's a difficult problem and there are no easy answers. And, you know, the idea that the government could very easily step in and do something, well, I mean, that's where I think APC comes in, because whatever government's about, whether it's the Liberals, the Conservatives, you know, the NDP, you know, federally, whatever, I think the idea is that, number one, a big guiding idea is to force a government to do what their responsibility is, and to not to look unswervingly on that, not to be tied politically, not to be cravenly subservient to chosen parties like the NDP, to point the finger at what's going on, and to look, make society look unflinchingly at what's, without flinching, what's going on, and like what people are going through. It's a really scary thing to see for people, but I don't think we should, you know, deviate from that course.
Can you speak about how you feel the situation downtown east side represents broader issues, right? Like the establishment of ghettos in North America is traditionally seen as a society of incredible wealth, as a society where, you know, people are surviving well economically, but the reality is that Canada presents a certain face to the world of prosperity or democratic rights and so on, but there's ghettos that exist in Canadian cities. So can you maybe talk about downtown east side within that international context?
Okay. Well, in the international context, one of the reasons the downtown east side is on the map these days is a lot of the work around harm reduction, where people, I guess scientists or doctors, whoever researching this, would come here, and there's a lot of international publicity around Vancouver. Like, they'd actually bring politicians here and go, this is what's going on. People came up from various towns in the States. You know, there are other examples like the downtown east side, but everyone who's come up here has always said, this is the weirdest, worst, biggest, strangest thing. You know, it's like, it's atypical. It's not your typical ghetto, right? In terms of describing the horrors or, you know, the misery of people living here, and you know, how much of it passes by as if it's not a problem. Like I don't know, it's like how many women disappeared from the downtown east side during 1996, 97, like when the NDP were throwing all these people off welfare. That's when they threw like 100,000 people off welfare. And it was pretty hard times then. And that was a time when the OD rate was skyrocketing, right? And these things were, you know, took so much to get noticed, right? And even then, you know, it's not like it's all disappeared, right? It's like when you ghettoize people, you put people in an area where people don't, where the society doesn't have to look at them. And, you know, the consequences of concentrating people in these areas with substandard services, with no health care, with lousy housing, no money, no jobs, no security, is that they die. And they die at a much faster rate than average people, than wealthier people. And that's the big chunk of what we're fighting against, is that, you know, they're killing us. And whether people kill you with, like, a gun or, like, some sort of act of parliament doesn't really matter that much. I mean, you're killing people.
You've been listening to an interview with Anton Pilipa, an organizer with the Anti-Poverty Committee in Vancouver's downtown east side. We will now hear an interview with a Palestinian refugee from Lebanon who compares life in the refugee camps of Lebanon to his life as a resident of East Hastings Street in Vancouver's downtown east side. Michel Chadian, the Palestinian refugee, compares the poverty and homelessness experienced by many residents of the downtown east side with his life in the Palestinian refugee camps of Lebanon.
My name is Michel Chadian. I was born in a refugee camp in Beirut, 1957. The camp used to be camp, it's not there anymore. The name is Jisr el Basha, means a Pasha bridge. It's a Turkish name, Basha. I've been in Canada 27 years. Now I live on Hastings for the last 2 years. It brings me lots of memories from the poverty which I lived in the past. I came to Canada looking for better life, but I don't think I had better life here because I seen more poverty in Canada, especially on Hastings Street, more than the refugee camp, because here we don't have family life or family value, so we could help each other, like back home, even in the refugee camp, because there we don't have drug problems. Here we have drug problems. Here you could have $500 in your pocket every month, but 2 hours later, you'll be looking for cigarette butt. There we used to wait for 10 kilos flour and maybe a couple of kilos of oil or rice for each individual as a refugee. We didn't never received any cash. We used to receive some blankets and old clothes. But the problem here is the poverty of diseases and drugs. What else?
How do you see these problems, these social problems, the economic poverty, the drug problems, the homelessness in this neighborhood, as coming from your history? As a Palestinian, talk about more your perception of, you know, Canada before you knew these realities.
As a human first and Palestinian second, I thought I'm coming same like other people got promise of the promised land. It was my promised land here, kind of. But I came here, it's completely different picture. I've been here more than half of my life. I've been here 27 years. I came here when I was 20. So I'm 47 right now. I tell you the truth, this is my opinion. I see there is more hope than here. Because here, once you got in trouble with drugs, with diseases, the end is death. Before death is pain. I could see it. There is each of us here for himself. Back there you could see we all lived together and we died together, we suffered together. But here I could see sometime over 50 people, but each of them by himself. What else? It's here is getting more rich and more poor. I live there and I live here. I live kind of, one woman told me, Canadian woman one time told me, you live in a limbo. You're not there and you're not here. Sometimes I'm afraid I want to go back there, but I don't know if I could live there, which I cannot live right here. The way I want to live, not just me, I want to see people around me live good. Then I could live okay.
Talk about that. You said there's a growing difference between the rich and the poor. So talk about this neighborhood and the reality that there's people living on the street, many, many people living on the street, and, you know, just miles away or kilometers away, you have people living in mansions.
From my perception, is it's gonna get worse and worse and worse. I just see more lineups for the sandwiches and the soup and some used clothes. They're pushing the religious communities, like the Christians, born again, Christian, whatever. For you to be able to have a soup and a sandwich, you have to listen to, excuse me, the whole mass, the whole service sometime. So it's not getting any better. From my experience, I grew up in a poverty, but I always looking, maybe a couple of blocks away from my refugee camp, I could see the beautiful buildings, beautiful cars, beautiful trees. Right here, I could see the same picture. I could see beautiful car going by and somebody looking for a bud of smokes or whatever. It's this generation is somehow, you gotta make him a little bit comfortable. I'm looking for another generation, because I came from different generation after generation. As a Palestinian, Canadian, I'm speaking, I could see more people coming into this life, especially in Canada, rich country, capitalist country, whatever you call it. My vision, I could see another one or two to three generation coming down with more poverty. It's gonna be worse. Believe me, it's gonna be worse. I'm not wishing it, but it's gonna be.
What's a shame? Too many of us are going insane.
You have been listening to a radio documentary about Vancouver's downtown east side. The downtown east side is one of Canada's most impoverished and destitute urban neighborhoods, often marked as the poorest postal code in Canada. Home to an estimated 5,000 injection drug users, the downtown east side suffers from one of the worst epidemics of HIV/AIDS in the world. I had the opportunity to interview and speak with residents and community organizers of Vancouver's downtown east side in February 2004 for CKUT Radio in Montreal. The on-the-street discussions and interviews touched on a variety of important issues directly relating to those struggling to survive in Vancouver's downtown east side, such as police brutality, homelessness, Indigenous self-determination, poverty, safe injection sites for drug users, the rights of sex workers, and many other issues directly relating to life and death in Vancouver's downtown east side. Get more information about Vancouver's Anti-Poverty Committee featured in this documentary, visit apc.resist.ca, or you can call 604-682-2726. To get more details concerning the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, visit www.vandu.org. That's vandu.org. This radio documentary was recorded and produced for CKUT Radio in Montreal by Stéphane Christophe. To order copies, call 514-398-6788 or email news@ckut.ca. That's 514-398-6788 or news@ckut.ca. Na 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 na.